And you were faced with the decision on whether to pardon or not. When would you pardon? When would be politically the best time to do it?
Well, it can't be now, because if it were done now, it would have the effect of being a cover-up for George Bush. And he doesn't need to answer that. The time to do it is sometime, of course, before you leave office, because unless you do it then, you're not going to have the power to do it.
We can't end this segment, Mr. President, without asking you about the other party. You have said that the only thing worse than being wrong in politics is being dull. Is Mike Dukakis too dull to be an effective Democratic nominee?
Let me answer that question this way. I've often said, too, that the best politics is poetry rather than prose. Jesse Jackson is a poet. Cuomo is a poet. And Dukakis is a word processor. That's what it gets down to. On the other hand, he's cool, he's intelligent, he's tough, he's good in debates. He's going to be a very formidable candidate.
All right, you talk about Jesse Jackson, and you have kind of conflicting views because you have said he is one of the best candidates in either party in this century. But on the other hand, you say that if he were white, he'd already be out of the race. Explain that.
Candidacy is very different from being one who should be elected. He's a superb candidate. Huey Long was a very good candidate, too. So was George Wallace. But on the other hand, neither should be president. What you have here is a situation where it isn't really the messenger, the fact that he is black, but it's the message. He is far to the left of the Democrats, and they are already very far to the left with Dukakis. So under the circumstances, if he were white, he would have been out already as being too extreme to have a chance to win. That's what I meant by it.
Mr. President, Mayor Koch says in the New York primary that Jews would have to be crazy to vote for Jesse Jackson. Do you think that that's fair of the mayor to say that?
Jesse Jackson's statements with regard to Hymetown, as we know, with regard to Israel, the fact that he, of course, has dealt with Arafat and others, would give certainly most Jews the idea that he's not one that favors their interest. Now, whether or not he should say that they would be crazy to, I noticed that there was a Jewish organization. Some Jews are endorsing him. I'm going to suggest, however, that if you're looking at it from the standpoint of Jewish issues, that Jackson has not been on the side of Jewish issues, and that all the other candidates, of course, can't wait but line up for those issues all the way down the line. I think that's the difference.
One very quick one. Sure. Democrats win in 88, Republicans win in 88. How does it come out?
It's going to be George Bush, but you're going to have a very long night. It's going to be decided in California, so be planning to spend double time and overtime for your staff over here.
They'll be happy to hear that.
The end.
George Bush and Dole over...
Well, I'm not... No, as far as who's going to win,
right.
It's going to be Bush with whoever he happens right. to select, that it might be Dole, that it might be Kemp, it might be right. one of the others. It will be, I believe, however... As far as Dukakis is concerned, Dukakis can't win unless he goes south. His first choice should be none. None will help him not only in the south, but also on the issue he's weak on, defense. And his second choice will be Gore.
Mr. President, we have to take a break now, but in a moment we'll turn to foreign policy and the U.S. role in the world. That's coming up when Meet the Press returns.
What I am talking about is not conquering North Vietnam, not destroying North Vietnam, but simply victory over aggression.
Mr. President, you disagree with some of Ronald Reagan's, the basic tenets of his foreign policy towards the Soviets, and I'd like to get your thinking on that if I could. First of all, the President's notion that Mikhail Gorbachev has renounced the idea of Soviet domination. You don't agree with that?
Well, I don't agree with it because of what Mikhail Gorbachev himself has said. I read very carefully the speech that he made at the 70th anniversary of the Communist Revolution in Russia. And I think I can remember exactly what he said. He said that 70 years ago, we parted with the old world once and for all. We are moving toward a new world, the world of communism. We will never turn off that road. Gorbachev may be a number of things. He may be more reasonable and all the rest, but he certainly has the same goal of a communist world to be accomplished maybe in other ways.
So are you troubled to see Ronald Reagan running around the country saying exactly the opposite, that Gorbachev has renounced this goal?
Ronald Reagan is saying that, and I'm sure that he believes it. On the other hand, he is one who is very shrewd, and he is one who, if he gets information which indicates that Gorbachev is not following that line, he'll turn on him very, very fast. So I have confidence that Reagan will handle it well.
You also disagree...
Just as he did at Reykjavik.
You also disagree with the president's emotional commitment to a perfect Star Wars defense shield to defend the U.S. against all nuclear missiles.
SDI has served a very useful purpose to date. If it hadn't been for SDI, we wouldn't be having the arms control negotiations we're presently having. What we have to remember, however, that as far as SDI is concerned, what is achievable is not a perfect shield. That research should go forward on that. Maybe we will find something in the next century that will deal with it. But what we can do immediately is to use SDI for the purpose of protecting our deterrent. To think unrealistically we can substitute SDI for the deterrence of our offensive weapon does not serve American foreign policy well.
I gather you also think that the president has gone along too much with the Soviet agenda, playing along too much with the emphasis on arms control and not linking it enough to progress on human rights and regional conflicts.
Well, the president certainly has been discussing human rights with Gorbachev. I know that from personal conversations I had with the president. And that is the way to handle human rights. Not expressly to condition any progress on arms control, for example, in human rights, but to do so in the private conversations that he's having. As far as other matters are concerned, however, I think what we have to remember is that arms control is the top of the Soviet agenda. That's what they want. The top of our agenda are those actions of the Soviet that make it necessary to have arms. And for example, as far as nuclear arms are concerned, it is the Soviet superiority in conventional weapons that must be dealt with.
Given all of these disagreements, do you have any concerns about the president going to Moscow and sitting down again with Mikhail Gorbachev next month?
No, when the president gets there, and after the president has had his briefings, he is going to be, I think, just as tough as he was at Reykjavik, when after going clear to the edge, a nuclear-free world and the rest, he backed off when Gorbachev insisted that he had to give up SDI. And the man that said no to Gorbachev at Reykjavik is going to say no to Gorbachev at Moscow if he believes that Gorbachev is not making the concessions he should on matters that really involve us. And certainly conventional arms involves us, and also what the Soviet Union does in regional issues, which could lead to the use of arms.
Mr. President, you talk to the president all the time, or with some regularity on the telephone about these matters. This administration, despite your confidence, has rejected linkage in the past of linking, for example, human rights or the Third World or conventional arms to arms control. What makes you so confident that this time the president will insist on those issues?
Well, first, Tom, I believe that the rejection of linkage has traditionally been the position of the Foreign Service. The Foreign Service of the State Department didn't agree with our going forward with linkage during our administration. It has always been their position. They believe you should go after this agreement, or that agreement. Now, that isn't the way it works with the Soviets. They link everything in their own minds, and we should do exactly the same thing. What I am saying here, though, that as far as President Reagan is concerned, well, that's the advice he's getting from the Foreign Service, that President Reagan is a very coony politician. And when push comes to shove, I think that he will practice linkage, even though he says he rejects it up to this point, because that's the advice he gets from the professionals.
Mr. President, in your book, as you prepare the readers for what they should expect from the Russians, you quote an Italian diplomat with whom you talked in the late 60s who said, "They are great liars, clever cheaters, magnificent actors. They consider it their duty to cheat and lie." Do you think that Mikhail Gorbachev considers it his duty to cheat and lie?
We have to understand that he has many things. He has great charm. He has high intelligence. And also, as distinguished from some of his predecessors, he's a pragmatist who knows he has serious problems and wants to deal with those problems. Now, insofar as tactics are concerned, you have to remember that anybody that studied the Marxist communist philosophy knows that they adopt the philosophy of any means to an end. Any means to an end, you do anything. You lie, you cheat, you do anything else. So under the circumstances, we've got to remember that as far as he's concerned, he's going to practice that. And as far as we're concerned, all we have to do is to make sure he doesn't get away with it.
Sir, I'd like to take you back to August of 1974, a couple of days before you left the White House. This is from Henry Kissinger's memoirs. He said that on the August the 6th, a Tuesday, President Nixon would cut off all military deliveries to Israel until it agreed to a comprehensive peace. He regretted not having done so earlier. He would make up for it now. His successor would thank him for it. I should prepare the necessary papers. Kissinger says the relevant papers were prepared but never signed. Can you tell me what was going on?
Well, I think what we were concerned there was with the fact that the Israelis were, we thought, intransigent at that point. And that we had to make a very solid, strong play in order to get them to move off of an entrenched position, which I didn't think was in their interest. Let me make a point with regard to Israel. Of course, as you may remember, I saved Israel, as Goldemeyer pointed out, through the airlift in 1973. We kept the Russians out through the alert in 1973, and it was a very tough decision and a very tough political
decision.
The
nuclear alert.
That's right, a nuclear alert. Just as Eisenhower kept them out in 1956 and 1958, with in effect what was nuclear warnings. Now, under the circumstances, what Israel has to understand is that for their own interest, they should make a deal now. Because if they don't make it now, they will wait until later. Now, they won five wars, they'll win the next one. But in the end, Arabs will learn to fight, and in the end, there are going to be more of them. And in the end, they will lose. And that's why I think we should certainly, in case of Israel's own interest, we should press them to make the deal now with regard to territories, etc., rather than waiting till later, till they're forced to make one that will not be in their interest.
Would, if you had been Senator Nixon this year in the U.S. Senate, would you have signed that letter of support for George Shultz's mission? 30 senators signed it.
No, I wouldn't have signed it. I would have agreed with what they were trying to do, but I wouldn't have signed it because I think that had a counterproductive effect insofar as the Israelis are concerned. You don't deal with them in a heavy-handed way. Shamir's a very proud man, and the minute the letter came out, he reacted exactly the opposite way. When I say, however, the sentiments, I well understand. I certainly understand the sentiments, and I know why they signed it, but I wouldn't have signed it myself because I think it would have been bad tactics.
Before we move away from the Middle East, you say that the Palestinians need self-government, but no separate homeland. How does that work?
What you have to be concerned about here is that Israel cannot have an armed Palestinian state in its gut. That's really what the issue is. On the other hand, Palestinians cannot continue to have Israelis ruling over them. And so the Palestinians must have, and I think the term that I use is not so much a homeland, self-government. And by self-government, I mean that they've got to have a system set up whereby they govern themselves. But it must be a neutral government. It must be one that poses no threat to Israel or to its neighbors. And that, incidentally, is in Israel's interest. But I should also say that accompanying that, Israel must have defensible borders. This idea that Israel should give up all the occupied territories, that won't fly with Israel, and it shouldn't. That has to be negotiated.
Mr. President, how well do you think President Reagan is handling the situation in Panama, and at what point, or at any point, should he be willing to use force, military force, to get General Noriega out?
I think he's handling it very well. I know that there are those who believe that he should use military force. I think it'd be a mistake. Noriega is an irritant to us, but we want to remember that in getting rid of that irritant, we don't want to cause much greater difficulties. In other words, the reaction that would occur all over Latin America in the event we used our military force to get rid of this irritant. What we have to do is to get rid of Noriega, but to have the Panamanian people do it, rather than the U.S. do it.
Are you convinced that the economic tools that the president is
economic,
using are going to force Noriega out?
Economic, diplomatic, and there's one other thing that I haven't seen suggested that I would like to suggest from this program. I've noticed that several Latin American countries have objected to the United States even using their economic power. They think that's improper for us to go that far. Why don't they then, in their interest, they know that Noriega ought to go, they ought to use their influence with Noriega to get him to go. I'd like to see the Latins start to do something about their own problem.
Could you envision a situation where the situation in Panama is so unstable that the U.S. would have to rethink giving the canal over to the Panamanians?
I do not think that is going to happen. I think the Panamanians are going to be realistic enough that before that happens, which of course would destroy their livelihood, that they're going to move on it themselves. But I emphasize again, the United States cannot be heavy-handed in Latin America, particularly with the Noriega, as indicated, it's, I think, by what has happened in Honduras. They have a riot. What was it about? It was about somebody that was thrown out of the country because of drugs. We've got to recognize what they are. We must deal with them as effectively we can, but sometimes it's much better to do it in a way that gets others to do the work for you, in this case the Panamanians or other Latin American governments, rather than the U.S. going in and doing it.
Mr. President, we have to pause for a moment, but we have many more questions for you, and we'll get to them when Meet the Press returns.
It is not that we believe, whether we believe it should be an issue. Both of us believe it should not be an issue. The question is, how do you keep it out of a campaign?
Meet the Press is sponsored by Radio...
Mr. President, I wanted to ask you one last follow-up question on the Mideast. Do you think that Secretary of State Shultz has accomplished anything in these weeks of shuttle diplomacy there?
You have to give him very high marks for trying. And incidentally, he's an excellent negotiator, as he demonstrated when he was serving as Secretary of Labor and handled George Meany and for us in that period. I would say, however, we have to realize that the problems in the Mideast are so complex that it can't be done by the Secretary of State on a part-time basis, and it can't be done even on a full-time basis by second-level State Department people, no matter how competent they are. There has to be the appointment of a full-time heavyweight negotiator, and that appointment should be made, I think, to Henry Kissinger. Now, Henry is devious, Henry is difficult, and some people think he's obnoxious, but he's a terrific negotiator. And I would suggest that the next president, be it Dukakis or Bush, would be well advised to give him the title of ambassador plenipotentiary, give him a year, and he will work out some settlement.
What does he think of this idea, let alone the description of him?
He'll kill me if he hears the program.
Well, I suspect it'll get back to him. I'd like to change subjects, if I could, and talk to you about the Iran-Contra affair. How serious was it as a foreign policy blunder, and how serious was it as a scandal?
It was more serious as a foreign policy blunder. And it was serious not for the points that have been emphasized most in the press, that is the trading arms for hostages, that certainly was a mistake, or for even the transfer of the arms to the Contras, the proceeds from the arms, that might have been illegal. The fatal flaw in the policy was selling arms to Iran, period, because it is not in the interest of the United States, or of Israel for that matter, to have Iran win this war. And anything that was done that might have helped them, even marginally in that respect, was not in our interest. That was the basic mistake.
How about as a scandal? The president misleading the country, keeping Congress in the dark, laws being broken?
Well, as far as the scandal is concerned, I think that that has been, if I may be permitted to say so, been built up in the media somewhat more than is justified. These were some very well-intentioned people. They thought they were carrying out the end, serving in the interest of the country. I think it was a mistake, but I do not believe that it was one of those massive scandals that destroyed confidence of the people in the President of the United States.
Do you really believe that John Poindexter and Bill Casey diverted funds to the Contras without telling Ronald Reagan?
Well, they said that, and under the circumstances, I would believe them, because John Poindexter said it under oath.
But on the other hand, let me just, if I could, one last question, Tom. Could that devious, obnoxious Henry Kissinger have carried out those kind of operations, sensitive, perhaps semi-legal or illegal operations in the White House? Would he have done that without telling you?
Now, let me say, I'm not saying he's devious and obnoxious. Other people do say that. But I would say that as far as Henry Kissinger is concerned, he wouldn't do it because he knows that he wouldn't get away with it if I were there.
Mr. President, you're an advocate of a strong presidency. You referred to it as the sovereign. A lot of people, however, see Iran-Contra and even Watergate as the tragic byproduct of a presidency that is too strong. People who come through those gates at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue believing that they have no allegiance other than to the president's wishes. Isn't one of the tests of a strong presidency a strong man controlling the people who work for him? And in this case, doesn't President Reagan fail that test because he simply didn't know what was going on in the basement of the White House?
No, I'm not going to suggest that President Reagan failed the test, because only somebody that is there can really make that judgment. I think we have to understand, though, that we mustn't learn the wrong lessons from what has happened in Iran-Contra. Rather than saying that we have to turn over everything to the State Department now and weaken the NSC, that would be a terrible mistake. Let me tell you, we wouldn't have had the opening to China. We wouldn't have had SALT I with the Soviet Union. We wouldn't have had the peace agreement ending the war in Vietnam unless we'd had a strong NSC and, of course, strong leadership from the White House. So we need to strengthen the NSC rather than to weaken it. We need covert actions. We need to limit the number of people that are covert actions, or of course, are revealed to. I'd limit it to only four, two in the House and two in the Senate. But the fact that this went awry must not mean that in the future we're going not to have covert actions or not have bold action. Those are the wrong lessons that could be learned. I would say, however, that you are absolutely right that a great responsibility is on whoever is president to see that when you have that much power, don't let it get out of line. I made, of course, very grievous errors in the Watergate matter. Fortunately, President Reagan didn't make that kind of error. He didn't have the problem of having to resign.
You're a student of history. Was there a Reagan revolution?
Well, the term revolution means many things to different people.
But the president's men say there's been a Reagan revolution.
Well, the president's men obviously are trying to say that Reagan made a difference. And the point is, he did make a difference. He made a difference, for example, with regard to the way the United States was perceived all over the world. He reestablished within the American people themselves a sense of confidence that had been lost. There was a Reagan revolution insofar as our priorities are concerned. Right now, for example, it's very difficult for people to talk about spending more. They're talking about how they're going to save money. Now, of course, the Reagan deficit is responsible for that, but that also has denied the Democrats their bread and butter issue. And I would say, finally, as far as the Reagan revolution is concerned, the attitudes on some of the social issues have changed. It is a revolution, I think, would be better stated if there's been a revolution in the way people approach issues, not a revolution in terms of what has been accomplished on those particular issues.
Do you think the more than $2 trillion spent on defense in the last 7 years has been wisely spent?
Never. The money spent in the Defense Department is never spent wisely. By that I mean there are many mistakes that are made. And the reason is that the Army, the Navy, the Air Force, and the Marine Corps are always fighting for their portion of the pie more than they're usually fighting for some of the other things that they should be fighting for. I don't mean that they aren't very loyal, very patriotic people, but that's the way the system works. It is very difficult to bring the Pentagon into line. I think Cap Weinberger was a fine Secretary of Defense, but he was representing the Secretary, representing the Defense Department, rather than trying to carry out what I think could have probably served the country better by knocking heads together and getting more money for what we were spending on defense.
How would you go about solving the country's drug problem?
I'd appoint a czar. We talk about, for example, the Army, Navy, and the Marine Corps fighting for turf. That, of course, is a Washington disease. And in the drug problem, we've got about 14 or 15 agencies that are so busy fighting each other that they aren't devoting their attention to fighting the common enemy. There should be a czar in the White House who pulls all the drug activities from the Justice Department, the Treasury Department, and the Customs and all together with complete and total authority and backing by the President. Now, the other point, I know there's a little controversy in the campaign here as to whether you can use the Army, Navy, Air Force, and Marines, and I'd say yes. They shouldn't be used if necessary, but we have to remember the purpose of our armed forces is to deal with an enemy of the United States. And believe me, those that engage in selling drugs, shipping drugs to this country, are killing people just as much as an enemy kills them. And if a way can be found, if it's necessary, in order to keep our borders clear, to have the Army, Navy, Air Force, Marine, or whatever, to stop the flow of drugs into this country, I would use them.
I'd like to go back, if I could, to something Tom brought up, which is the way Ronald Reagan does his job. I don't mean the big initiatives, but the day-to-day way he does his job, because it seems so different from the way you did the job. When you read that he's unable to remember whether or not he signed an intelligence finding, when you read that he doesn't know some of the basic facts of arms control, does that offend you at all?
No, it certainly doesn't offend me, because he's been very successful. By that I mean...
Well, he's had his problems too, though, as a result of that.
But we've got to look at all of our presidents and their strengths and their weaknesses and so forth. And I had mine, and he has his. I would say in his case, he just does not spend that much time on details.
Isn't there a danger in that, though, Mr. President?
There can be a danger, particularly if you don't have staff people who spend that time. But Ronald Reagan, when he has good staff, and when he can handle the big picture, he does a superb job. When his staff is weak, then you have problems.
What do you make of Mrs. Reagan's role, her influence on policy, her apparently extraordinary clout with the White House staff?
Well, Mrs. Reagan is to be admired for what she's done, for example, in the drug program. I admire that. I admire also her enormous loyalty and support to her husband. That's her only interest. She's not interested in herself. And I would say that as far as her influence is concerned, she has pretty good political antenna. And so her advice generally, I think, has been very good.
Mr. President, you made a reference in this program to the restlessness in the society, even in a time of prosperity, and Jesse Jackson is able to capitalize on. In fact, during the past 8 years of Ronald Reagan's administration, the rich have gotten richer, the middle class are struggling harder than they ever have in the past, and the poor are poorer. So there is a real foundation for that restlessness. And in fact, the Republican Party, according to Bob Dole, has to reach out to those minority groups and find a way to address the needs of the so-called underclass in America. Do you think that that has been a failure of the Reagan administration?
No, what has happened here is that, and we have to realize this, is that in order to afford what we want to do for people, it's necessary to produce wealth. Now, we can talk all we want about how we can distribute wealth, but if we don't have people out there producing wealth, forget it. Now, in this administration, we have to realize the economy has grown, there have been more jobs, we've been able to afford more, and we don't want to kill the goose that lays the golden egg. I do say this, and I agree with Bob Dole on this, and I know that George Bush feels the same way. We just don't stand on the record. We got to build on it. I pointed out a moment ago that Jesse Jackson has struck a responsive chord with the American people because he's talking about family, he's talking about drugs, he's talking about the poor, he's talking about the homeless. They are there. And I would hope that, and I am confident this will be the case, that in the next Republican administration, they will now be able to devote attention to those that have been left behind. Because you see, conservatism at its best is compassionate.
Do you think that this administration has been compassionate enough?
This administration has been compassionate in many ways, but the emphasis in this administration has been primarily on basically, I would say, to use a term or coin a term, it's been on the supply side. In other words, to build up the wealth of this country so that we can afford to do other things. Now let's see that now that we have done that, I think it's necessary to see what we can do to deal with these other problems.
Some people have called this decade the decade of greed. Is that an apt description?
There's nothing wrong at all with greed, provided that greed is one that contributes to the wealth of the country, so that the wealth of the country can then handle some of the problems that people want. Let me tell you, if some people weren't greedy, we wouldn't have the tax money that we could even be talking about, more for education, more for health and the rest.
Mr. President, with a celebration of greed, we're going to have to break in for a moment. But we'll be back with some final questions about your place in history in just a moment when Meet the Press returns.
I would say that, generally speaking, those that are discovering the new Nixon probably didn't know the old one.
To so many people this week in preparing for this interview, and I must say that, and I'm sure you won't be surprised to hear this, they have very ambivalent feelings about you. They think that you make great sense on foreign policy, perhaps more sense than almost anyone else on the public scene these days. But on the other hand, there is still a deep feeling about the breach of trust in Watergate. How do people reconcile that?
Well, it's very difficult to reconcile, and I understand that, because Watergate was a breach of trust. I think to keep it in perspective somewhat, and I think it is important that as we consider this historical segment of the program that we put it in perspective, that 1972, as you know, was a very big year. A lot of things were going on. Winston Churchill once wrote that strong leaders usually do the big things well, but they foul up on small things, and then the small things become big. I should have read that before Watergate happened. In 1972, we went to China, we went to Russia, we ended the Vietnam War effectively by the end of that year. Those were the big things. And then here was a small thing, and we fouled it up beyond belief. It was a great mistake. It was wrong, as I pointed out over and over again. But under the circumstances, now people, as they judge that period, have to see what we accomplished and what we did wrong. And for the future, I would advise all those that follow me and the position of president, do the big things as well as you can. But when a small thing is there, deal with it. Deal with it fast. Get it out of the way, because if you don't, it's going to become big, and then it may destroy you.
Whenever you go public, and you are going to go public now with a series of interviews in association with the release of this book, 1999, there's a good deal of speculation about Richard Nixon trying to make a comeback. And there's always the question, what does Richard Nixon want? Do you want to erase the stigma of Watergate? Do you want to be a player again at the national table in the debate of national issues? Are you just trying to sell your book? What does Richard Nixon want?
Well, as far as selling the book is concerned, that's no problem, because I got a very good advance on it, and it isn't going to make any difference whether it sells that much or not. Now, my purpose at the present time is, frankly, to get the message across. I have some very strong feelings about foreign policy. I've had a lot of experience, not just in Soviet-American relations, but in Chinese-American relations, in the Mideast, in Latin America, Africa, etc., in Europe. I feel I want to pass on that experience before I'm too old to be able to do so, to articulate it. That's why I'm going out. As far as restoring my, making a comeback, what am I going to come back to? We already have a very good mayor in
Saddle River.
Saddle River. Mm-hmm. Yes. And we have a very good governor, as somebody has suggested, in the state of New Jersey. It isn't a comeback. It isn't to be well thought of, but the purpose is to get a message across, and then let history judge.
Mr. President, when you were describing Watergate as a small thing that happened in a busy year, I know that a lot of people will have trouble with that characterization, because it was a break-in, after all, led by the president's men, and it wasn't just 1972. This went on through 1973 and into 1974 as well. It involved a conspiracy, the misuse of money, and it involved perjury. People went to jail for it. Is it fair, really, to characterize it only as a small thing that was a mistake?
Oh, no. I think you misheard me. I said it was a small thing that became a very big thing. It was a small thing, the break-in, and break-ins have occurred previously. In other campaigns as well. At that point, we should have done something about it. We should have exposed it, found out who did it, rather than attempting, as was, to contain it, to cover it up. It was the cover-up that was wrong, and that was a very big thing. There's no question about that at all. You're absolutely right.
Mr. President, as you know, generations of Americans have been students of Richard Nixon, admirers and detractors. Even your admirers describe you as a complex man. We're all a little self-critical at some time in our lives, some more than others, of course. In the autumn of your years, as you are reflective about your own life's experiences, personal and as a politician, what criticism do you have with your own behavior or style or things that you've done?
As president?
As president or as a human being?
Well, we don't have much time to cover the human being. Let's start with the president. First, naturally, the Watergate matter should have been handled properly. I should have concentrated on, and apart from the fact that it was wrong, it was stupid. And generally, I'm called many things, but not often am I called stupid. I would say the major mistake I made as president was one, and this will surprise you, was not doing early in 1969 what I did on May 3rd of 1972 and on December 15th of 1972. And that was to bomb and mine North Vietnam. I wanted to do it. I talked to Henry Kissinger about it. but we were stuck with the bombing halt that we had inherited from the Johnson administration, with Paris peace talks. I knew that just like the ceasefire talks down here in Nicaragua, I didn't trust them at all, and they proved to be, of course, phony. But if we had done that then, I think we would have ended the war in Vietnam in 1969 rather than in 1973. That was my biggest mistake as president.
And what about when you are self-critical of your personal style or how you treat people or how you look at the world? Do you see anything that you might have done differently?
Well, I suppose I could have treated the press better.
Well, I wasn't looking for that necessarily.
But then they might have treated me better. No, I think under the circumstances, it's very difficult for one to psychoanalyze himself. You know, I don't go much for this psycho history. I don't go much for psycho TV shows either. I think they're rather revolting. And as far as sitting down and psychoanalyzing myself and saying, now, how could I have been a better person? It's just not my bag.
Well, let me just follow on to what Tom said. How do you think you'll be remembered? You're a pretty good judge. You read a lot of history. Write me a paragraph that might be written around the turn of the century and the next century about Richard Nixon.
When you talk about writing a paragraph, John, it would be difficult for me because writing is very hard for me. I know that you fellows, you just type it right off. It comes off the top of your head.
You just try ad-libbing it, sir.
But under the circumstances like this book, it was hard work. I don't think I could do it in a paragraph. People say, will history treat you well? History will treat me fairly. Historians probably won't, because most historians are on the left, and I understand that. I would say that as people look back on the Nixon administration, they're probably most likely to remember 50 years from now, 100 years from now, that it made a difference on a very major issue. We changed the world. If it had not been for the China Initiative, which only I could do at that point, we would be in a terrible situation today, with China aligned with the Soviet Union and with the Soviet Union's power. The China Initiative hasn't brought peace to the world. We can't be sure what will happen, but without it, we would be in a terrible shape.
Do you think at all about how different the world would have been had you been able to finish your second term? I was thinking the other day, probably Jimmy Carter would never have been president. Perhaps Ronald Reagan wouldn't have been. Do you have thoughts about what you could have accomplished in the rest of a second term and how, flowing from that, America would have been so different?
My priorities were these. One, interestingly enough, one of the first ones, the Mideast. That I talked about it over and over again with Henry Kissinger in February and March of 1973. Second was, we would not have lost the war in Vietnam. I would have seen to it that we would have forced the North Vietnamese to keep the Paris Peace Agreement, and that would have meant that we wouldn't have had basically what happened in all the places around the world, Cambodia, Laos, even what happened in Africa and even in Nicaragua. The other point is that I think we would have done something at home. There was an area particularly I was interested in, and that was to have a real welfare program. I am concerned about the fact that when you look at blacks, they are worse off today, generally speaking, on an average, than they were in 1966 when the Great Society program started. And the problem is the family. We've got to do something about that, and our family assistance program was the right way to go. I'm glad that Moynihan's following up on it today.
Mr. President, I'm sorry we're going to have to break it off. I want to thank you very much for coming in today and sharing very generously your thoughts with us. Appreciate it very much. My thanks also to my colleagues, Tom Brokaw and John Chancellor. And that's Meet the Press for this week. I'm Chris Wallace. For all of us here at NBC News, have a good week.